This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we celebrate a big victory. Charges were dropped against pipeline activists in Louisiana. We're going to speak with Ann Whitehat, a Native American, on her actions in Louisiana, and with her Center for Constitutional Rights attorney, Pam Spees. The Voting Rights Act of 1965, which was the great triumph of the civil rights movement, has been killed by the Republican Party. We speak today with attorney Marjorie Cohn about what was at stake, what they've done, and what we can do about it.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The climate movement won a significant victory on July 13th, with all charges being dropped against 16 pipeline protesters and a journalist. The local district attorney in St. Martinsville, Louisiana, rejected all criminal charges and vowed not to prosecute them for alleged violation of Louisiana's anti-protest amendments to their critical infrastructure law. The Bayou Bridge pipeline is the tail end of the infamous 1,172-mile-long Dakota Access Pipeline, which brings dirty oil from North Dakota to the Gulf of Mexico. The end of the pipeline runs from Texas through Louisiana. In 2018, in the midst of fierce opposition to the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, and at the urging of an industry association, the Louisiana legislature added pipelines to the definition of critical infrastructure to significantly raise the penalties for people protesting pipeline projects. Those found guilty could now be punished with 5 years in prison, with or without hard labor. This critical infrastructure law is part of a national effort to crack down on environmental activists across the USA. The law in Louisiana was adopted from model legislation put forward by ALEC, a corporate-funded politically conservative group with enormous influence. Similar legislation aimed at pipeline protesters has been introduced more than 23 times in 18 states since 2017 and is in effect in 15 of them. Karen Savage, an independent journalist who was arrested, said that, quote, "The First Amendment guarantees water protectors the right to protest and protects my right as a journalist to report those protests without fear of retribution." We speak today with Ann Whitehat, one of the people arrested and charged under the law. We speak also with the Center for Constitutional Rights attorney, Pam Spees, one of the team of attorneys that handled the criminal defense case. She's also representing Ann Whitehat in a case challenging the constitutionality of the Louisiana law. Ann, welcome to Law and Disorder. And Pam, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Ann, please talk about your background. We'll get into how you got involved with this protest. But what's your background? What brought you to this?
Absolutely. Thank you. First, I'd like to just introduce myself. Chante Washte Nape Chuzapi Medakwiapi and Whitehat Imachiapikshto Ohitikawi Mie. That's my formal, that's my greeting. I'm Suchangu Lakota from Rosebud, South Dakota. That's my language. I introduced myself to everybody. I am a mother of three. I live in New Orleans, Louisiana for about 11 years now. Been an organizer for about 25 years. And when I moved to New Orleans, I was really burned out, so I just put all my organizing behind me and I focused on raising my kids. And then Standing Rock happened and I saw my relatives up there getting attacked by the dogs, having the mercenaries out there. And so we packed up and we went to the front line. I took my kids up there with a whole group of folks here from New Orleans. And so that's how we were introduced to Energy Transfer Partners, okay, as the company that is the parent company for the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. So we came home to New Orleans, continued our life in organizing, and then got word that the Bayou Bridge Pipeline was coming down here to South Louisiana at the tail end. Yeah, so a bunch of us down here merged and joined forces and put up a viable, you know, like I said, we put up a defense against this black snake down here. So that's how I got involved, in a nutshell.
And what were your goals and that of your fellow protesters when you were when you got arrested at the Bio Bridge. You were in a kayak swamp. Tell us about what you were trying to accomplish.
Well, at that time, my comrades in the swamp, in the kayaks, were the first ones to be arrested. And so when we studied the law, and we found the loopholes, basically, on ways that we could actually continue to stop the construction. And one of them was that they couldn't do construction on a waterway. And so if folks were in the waterway, they couldn't continue the construction there. After this law went into effect, that was considered part of the easement, illegally, of course, and that's what we're challenging, but that's how they were able to basically yank our comrades out of their kayaks in the alligator and snake-infested waters and arrest them under these bogus charges that were just dismissed.
Pam, please tell us about your background and what led you up to the point that you got to be representing Ann Whitehat and her comrades.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, and it's great to be back on Law and Disorder. I'm so glad you guys are still here doing your thing. Yeah, it is a privilege to be able to represent Ann and others who've been involved in this fight. I'm originally from Louisiana. The environmental racism, the environmental degradation, it's something that I've seen up close and personal, and it's been a sort of a circuitous route back to Louisiana. I'm a staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and when, you know, we'd also been watching what was playing out at Standing Rock, and when we heard that this private mercenary company was trying to get into Louisiana, that had wreaked so much havoc around the Dakota Access Pipeline. When we heard they were trying to get into Louisiana, felt very concerned for people there. You know, were supporting their efforts to try to keep that company out, and they were successful. It wasn't allowed in. That was in 2017. But from then on, we just saw the attacks on protesters increasing. And so you had this 162-mile tail end of the same network of pipelines that connect to the DAPL. What, you know, the things that Ann and others were doing were having an impact, and the pipeline was being challenged in the courts. And so what we saw happen in Louisiana was something that began to happen around the country, where you had the Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association pushing state legislators to really severely, dramatically increase the penalties for pipeline protesters by adding what we call the anti-protest amendments to Louisiana critical infrastructure law. They don't have to push too hard in Louisiana. I mean, that. So in 2018, we saw the industry lobbyists really escalate their efforts, and they basically drafted legislation that they were able to very easily push through the Louisiana legislature. They added what we call anti-protest amendments to Louisiana's critical infrastructure law. That went in, and it basically created felonies for people being on or near pipelines. It's very vague, and that's one of the problems with the law. But they went into effect on August 1st, of 2018, and then the first arrests were just days later, where people were kayaking on navigable waters and were pulled from those kayaks by law enforcement who were moonlighting as private security that had been hired by the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, by Energy Transfer Partners. And then in the weeks to follow, we'd see more arrests, including Ann's arrest for a protest out on property, where it turns out it was the pipeline company itself that was trespassing. We actually got a court ruling to that effect later on. So it just further highlights the absurdity and outrageousness of these laws and what they're really aimed at.
The arrests were in 2018, and finally the charges were dropped 3 years later, just a couple of weeks ago. Pam, what did you do over these 3 years to get the case dropped?
So all of the arrests happened in a parish we call, in Louisiana, we call counties parishes, and in St. Martin Parish. And so there were 17 people in total who had been arrested under this law, and were facing felonies punishable by up to 5 years in prison. And what we had done in the meantime was we had mounted a challenge to the constitutionality of that law, and that has been pending since 2019. So the DA was one of the defendants in that case, along with the sheriff and the attorney general. And we think this particular DA was sort of waiting to see what was going to happen in the constitutional challenge. And in May, thankfully, a federal judge in Louisiana allowed the case to proceed over their motions to dismiss. So we're moving into the substantive challenge, and I think that really prompted the DA, who had not accepted these charges all along, to formally reject them and vow not to prosecute. In one way, what he has said, and of course, you know, we with co-counsel Bill Quigley have been, you know, in touch with the DA's office urging them to not prosecute these cases. And of course, just having these charges hanging over their heads have had an impact on their lives. He finally formally rejected them. I think there's a calculation that perhaps they think this might get them out of the constitutional challenge. We don't think it will. But all of these things were playing, you know, on these multiple tracks, and finally one of the right things happened, and it's significant for the people who've had these charges hanging over them this whole time.
Pam, what are the issues in the affirmative lawsuit that you're bringing? What are you alleging is wrong with this law, and what kind of defense is the industry putting up? I should say the state, but it's really the industry behind them. What's their defense to this?
Right. Well, first, let me just say that the Louisiana's law is just one version of legislation that's being pushed around the country through the industry association known as ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. Louisiana was one of the first states to implement this model legislation. It exists now in at least 15 states in some form or other. And Louisiana, though, was the first state to also, where there were also arrests under this law. And so what we've said is that the law is unconstitutional because it clearly targets people exercising their First Amendment rights. It targets particular viewpoints, right, for discrimination. It's clearly aimed at pipeline protesters. But we've also said that it's also a violation of due process because it's so vaguely worded. Because one of the things about Louisiana is that there are over 125,000 miles of pipeline in Louisiana, most of which is underground. You can't see it. You could be standing on it at any given point and not know it. And so therefore it violates due process because it's so vague. You can't know, you know, what conduct could get you into sort of criminal trouble. That's what we're pleading in this case. The defenses so far have been that federal courts shouldn't have no business engaging in these questions of state, the constitutionality of state statutes. They've suggested that, well, the AG was dismissed from the case, but the sheriff and the DA were left in. They've challenged the standing of all the plaintiffs initially, in addition to Ann and Ramon Mejia and Karen Savage, who were all arrested and charged under this law. There were other environmental organizations who were in the case, and the landowners, right, who in this case had given protesters permission to be on their property, had not given the pipeline company permission to be on the property, and yet it was their invitees, Ann and others, who were arrested. They were part of the case. Defendants were also challenging the standing of all of these folks, and ultimately everyone but Ann and Ramon and Karen were dismissed from the case once the attorney general was dismissed.
So, Anne, is the Bayou Bridge pipeline functioning right now? And if so, what's the danger of this pipeline?
Hi, yes, the Bayou Bridge pipeline is functioning as well as the Dakota Access Pipeline. And all of the same fears that we have been telling everybody since the beginning are still there. These pipelines leak. There's bound to be leaks and breaks in this pipeline, endangering, you know,
all of this pristine, beautiful drinking water and wetlands. So it's the same. It's the same concerns that we've had since the beginning. Yeah, that's just basically it. It's the same. It's the same concerns we had in terms of pipelines.
Well, and Michael, I would add, I was just this week looking at the federal record keeping on leaks and accidents, and there's already been one for the Bayou Bridge pipeline in St. Martin Parish where all of these fights were playing out. And, you know, so that's been a concern all along. And then the other concern for everyone involved in these fights was that it ends in St. James, Louisiana, in the heart of an historic African American community that's already overburdened by petrochemical facilities. And those folks in St. James knew that if this pipeline was allowed to be built, it was going to be pumping an additional 500,000 barrels of oil into their community a day, which would then bring more facilities and really spell what they feared would be the end of their communities. All of this is playing out in the context of really deep concerns about climate change after the pandemic, understanding the disproportional impacts on Black communities and communities of color, especially where there's this kind of air pollution. All of it's playing out in really, really horrific and concerning ways.
If it leaks, will it affect drinking water?
Absolutely. It goes into one of the biggest drinking water the supplies down here, and then also the community of St. James. They literally have one road out of their community, and that was one of the things that we were advocating mm-hmm. for, because the terminus of the Bayou Bridge pipeline is in their community. But they literally have one way out if there is a huge disaster in that community, because a chemical company bought the road and the access and the property for the other way out of that community. So it is a very dangerous situation at the tail end of these pipeline construction projects. And unfortunately, as it's always been, the folks of color, who are really the majority of people in this and the whole world, are going to be suffering. And so one of the things that we have to continue to fight against, and actually just to protect our people.
When you talk about environmental racism, does this mean that the incidences of cancer and other diseases is higher in these areas than in other places?
Absolutely. That's been documented in that area, specifically called Cancer Alley, which the residents have recently just renamed Death Alley. So this is not new news, okay? This is something that has been documented for a long time, and a lot of folks have perished due to this.
The Dakota Access Pipeline is still unfortunately functioning. It connects with the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, and it brings oil in from the Bakken fields in North Dakota. I understand that this oil is particularly dirty, and I wanted to ask you, is burning fossil fuels, why is it so harmful to the quality of our air, particularly these dirty oil fuels?
Well, it's a direct impact on our climate change, okay? You know, we're going to be polluting the air. And this is just one huge destructive cycle that has begun. And it starts at the beginning with the Bakken oil fields and what is happening up there, not only to the environment, and then what it circles back and happens to us. We're basically at the tail end of that as well in terms of climate change and creating what, you know, the first climate refugees that are coming out of the Gulf. Our indigenous people. There's this like a huge cycle, a huge circle. So it not only is coming out from the air and impacting folks, but also what's going through that actual pipeline and the destruction that's happening. Not just what we have witnessed, it's the same thing that is happening all the way along on the 75-foot wide corridor for thousands and thousands of miles, disrupting every life force that is in its way. Whether it be the air above it, down to the groundwater below it, and spreading out.
And are you in an organization of climate protectors down there?
I would say I'm part of a larger movement of climate protectors. Our movement to work to stop the Bayou Bridge pipeline at the Lualaba camp was our resistance movement, which has since sort of morphed into food forests on that land and, you know, some other projects. But we've definitely have kept our organizing movement flourishing in other ways.
What kind of activities are you currently involved in, Anne?
For myself, here in New Orleans, you know, with these charges hanging over our heads for the last 3 years, for me personally, it sort of lit a fire under me to do as much as I can possibly do, because you never know if I'm going to be going to prison for 10 years, okay?
Yeah, at hard labor.
Yes, at hard labor. So I basically created my own sweatshop in my house, and I make herbal remedies. I've been doing it for many, many years, and I helped to start a collective here called Delta Roots in New Orleans. We're a collective of what I call radical herbalists, and we began as a collective to make remedies for the front lines, because we know what it's like to be on the front lines and need medicine. And then also, after COVID hit, we stopped all production here in New Orleans. We were hit really, really, really hard at the very at the onset. And so we switched gears, and we have since developed a line of remedies that we distribute to indigenous communities, specifically for COVID-positive relatives. So we have herbal cough syrup, we have tonics, tinctures, a chest rub, and also some tea blends to help us deal with our grief and healing and heart healing. So that's what I'm up to, along with organizing around our indigenous communities for right now. We're doing some awareness around the deaths of the Indian children, the native indigenous children who have been discovered in the mass graves at boarding schools, church-run and government-run boarding schools. So the movement of work is still going on. It's going on in different ways of healing and also mostly just really healing right now. And I'm also hoping to get up to line 3 soon and support them on the front line.
So if our listeners wanted to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
You can go, I'm on Facebook. I'm kind of too busy to be on all the social media, so I mostly just do Facebook, Delta Roots and White Hat, or White Hat Botanicals is also my trade name for my own personal product line.
Great. And Pam, I wanted to ask you, what are the next steps in your litigation?
Yeah, well, you know, it's you heard Ann saying at the beginning, at the top, you know, that they were, after this law went into effect, she called them loopholes. I think of them as really people just in a state where there's just these expanding crackdowns and escalations by industry and law enforcement, people just trying to find ways of speaking and expressing opposition to these dangerous, deadly, you know, the state just wants to keep continuing down this deadly path, right? And so there have been other arrests as well, you know, Pastor Manning, a black leader from New Orleans, standing with people in Cancer Alley, was arrested for inciting a riot. And we had two other environmental advocates who were arrested for terrorizing. And those charges, all of those charges were ultimately rejected, but it's just a sign that here in Louisiana, they keep trying to escalate and scare people away from speaking out. So this case is very important. You know, the fact that these charges were just rejected is very important for people not only in Louisiana, but in these fights around the country. So the next steps are we have a trial date now set for next September. And between now and then, we're going to be in discovery. We're going to be asking a lot of tough questions of these officials and people working for them, and really trying to shed some light on what was going on between industry and these law enforcement agencies in the meantime. So stay tuned. It's going to get interesting in a different way pretty soon.
Yeah, well, we'll certainly have both of you back on the show. I wanted to ask you if you could tell our listeners how people can follow your work and how they can follow the progress of this case.
Yeah, well, we're tracking the progress of the case on our website, ccrjustice.org, and there's a case page there called White Hat v. Landry, where we keep track of everything that's going on. You can follow us on Twitter at the CCR on Twitter, and of course Facebook as well. I'm on Twitter, but like Anne, I just can't seem to find the time to be there very often. So follow at the CCR, and you'll get information about the case there.
Both of you, do you have any last thoughts before we come to an end to our allotted time and we have to say goodbye?
Yeah, I would just tell folks out there just to please keep the fire going, okay? Don't stop. Don't be afraid of what these companies and in collusion with the law enforcement, what they throw at you, because we need to stand up right now and continue this fight and stand up for not only our neighbors and our kids, but for the rights of Mother Earth as well. So I encourage folks to use your voice and continue to do that work, and don't be afraid.
It's an honor to be able to speak with both of you. The work you're doing is terrific. Pam, did you have any final thoughts before you have to say goodbye?
I think that was a mic drop from Anne. I don't think there's anything to add from that, and you can see why it's an honor to be able to represent her and others in this fight. And appreciate you, Michael. Thanks for having us on.
It's a joy to be able to speak with both of you and contemplate the victory that you had. We'll get back to you as this case develops, Pam. And Anne Whitehat, thank you so much for being on Law & Disorder. Pam Spies, thank you for being back as our guest on Law & Disorder. We'll be speaking again, I hope, to announce another victory. You two take it easy.
You thank too. You. Take good care.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
When I'm going back home, I'm going back down the street. When I go back home, I'm going back down the street. Where me and my baby live happy and stay every day.
We're in the middle of a second great disenfranchisement in America. The first was after the Civil War Reconstruction ended. Legislatures in Republican-run states are rushing to impose new voting restrictions, particularly on non-white voters. The Brennan Center in New York City found that as of June 20th, 17 states enacted 28 new laws restricting the ability to vote since the start of the year. Republican-run states voted to restrict voting by mail and in person, voting hours and locations, and implemented voter registration and voter ID requirements. Georgia banned giving food or water to voters waiting in long lines that were caused by reduced polling access in black precincts. They get away with this by raising the imaginary problem of voter fraud. The Supreme Court has 6 reactionary judges and 3 liberals. 3 of the reactionaries were added to the court by Donald Trump. The recent decision in Brnovich delivered a huge hit to American democracy, such as it is. The decision makes the court look like an obvious political institution where justices are simply partisan politicians with robes. In Brnovich versus the Democratic National Committee decision, the court eviscerated the strongest remaining sections of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, which held that election laws and voting rules, which actually had a racially discriminatory impact, could be blocked. The first major blow to the Voting Rights Act was in 2013. There, the court held in Shelby versus Holder that federal authorities could no longer block regressive new election laws or voting rules in jurisdictions with histories of discrimination. Effectively, most of the Voting Rights Act is now dead, declared Hamline University scholar David Schultz, who specializes in elections. We speak today with former National Lawyers Guild President Marjorie Cohn. She is a professor emerita of constitutional law at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego, California. She has written about election restrictions, most recently in an article for Truthout. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Marjorie, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 forbids any voting procedures that, quote, result in a denial or abridgment of the rights of any citizen of the U.S. to vote on account of race, end quote. What did the recent Supreme Court decision in the case of Branovich versus the Democratic National Committee do to this law?
Well, it really gutted the law, Michael. It now, in the future, according to the Supreme Court case, where the six right-wingers gutted Section 2 and the three liberals dissented, it gives the benefit of the doubt to states that enact voter suppression laws, basically. It makes it easier for courts to uphold laws like the two laws in Arizona, the out-of-precinct policy, which requires election officials to throw out a ballot if it was cast at the wrong precinct, and the other voter restriction is ballot harvesting, where people who don't have access to drop boxes or don't have transportation to get to the post office can ask other people, third persons, to deliver their ballots for them, and it basically criminalizes, makes it a felony for people to deliver ballots for other people. And yet the Supreme Court upheld both of those Arizona voter suppression laws, saying that there are modest burdens on people of color, but they're small, and not only that, the state's interest in preventing fraud overcomes any minor disparate burden on people of color.
Let me ask you about the question of fraud. The Republicans have raised the specter of voter fraud to support the various laws they're now enacting. Is fraud a reality?
It's not. There are virtually no cases of fraud, occasionally one in millions of votes. And that voter fraud is when people vote twice or dead people vote. And yet we heard this mantra of voter fraud, from Trump and the Republicans before the election, during the election, since the election, as an excuse why Joe Biden won and Trump lost. But the really alarming thing about this decision, and Alito writes for the six right-wing majority, and he admits that, well, there is no evidence of voter fraud, but there might be in the future, and it should go without saying that a state may take action to prevent election fraud without waiting for it to occur and be detected with its own borders. So basically, he's setting up a straw man as an excuse and then saying, well, even if there's no proof of fraud, you never know, there might be in the future, so we have to prevent that by preventing people of color from voting. He didn't say that last part, but that's the effect.
Justice Kagan wrote an exceptionally strong dissent in this case. She wrote it for the three liberals on the court. And I wondered whether you could read part of that for us.
Yes. Justice Kagan lambasted the majority for writing its own set of rules and limiting Section 2 from multiple directions. And she says that the majority rests its decision on a list of mostly made-up factors at odds with Section 2 itself. And then Kagan, writing for the dissenters, says that these so-called important circumstances that the court invents all cut in one direction toward limiting liability for race-based voting inequities. And Kagan accuses the majority of creating a set of extra textual exceptions and considerations to sap the Voting Rights Act's strength and save laws like Arizona's. And she charges that the court is usurping Congress's role. Congress, of course, writes legislation, not the courts. And Kagan adds, no matter what Congress wanted, the majority had other ideas. So very strong language from Justice Kagan.
Yeah, well, she said that the Voting Rights Act represented what the best of America stood for, and its destruction represents the worst. What are the new rules that they set out, the majority of the Supreme Court put these new rules out that would support voter suppression measures?
Well, they call them guideposts, but they're really roadblocks to voter equality, as required by the Voting Rights Act. So the first so-called guidepost that the majority sets out is, how big is the burden on people of color? That's highly relevant, they say. After all, every voting rule imposes a burden of some sort, and people must tolerate the usual burdens of voting. Mere inconvenience is not enough to demonstrate a violation of Section 2, so downplaying the burden on people of color. Secondly, how much does the voting rule at issue depart from the standard practice when Section 2 was amended in 1982? In 1982, Congress said that in order to challenge a voting restriction, you don't have to show that the legislature that enacted that rule intended to discriminate against people of color, as long as the effect was discriminatory. And in 1982, states typically required nearly all voters to cast their ballots in person on election day and allowed only narrow and tightly defined categories of voters to cast absentee ballots. Judges who really looked clearly at these voter suppression laws could use this particular guidepost to strike down new burdens on in-person voting, but they would allow restrictions on mail voting and early voting. Then the third guidepost is the size of any disparities in the impact a rule has on members of different racial or ethnic groups. And Alito wrote for the reactionary majority, small disparities are less likely than large ones to indicate that a system is not equally open. But the mere fact there is some disparity in impact does not necessarily mean that a system is not equally open or that it does not give everyone an equal opportunity to vote. So once again, diluting that requirement of showing a disparity. And then number four, the courts are supposed to look at other available voting opportunities that the state provides. So, for example, if there is absentee ballots, if people can get absentee ballots without showing an excuse, maybe the courts would accept restrictions on election day voting. And, of course, it all depends on the judges. And then the fifth guidepost is the state's interest in preventing fraud, which Alito said could undermine public confidence in the fairness of elections and the perceived legitimacy of the announced outcome. Well, of course, he's talking about the Trumpsters. And again, Alito reiterated that even if there is no evidence of fraud, and there was none in this case, there might be in the future. So that and it seems in the analysis that the court comes to come to the conclusion that they upheld both of the Arizona voter suppression laws, that the state's interest in preventing some hypothetical mythical fraud actually took precedence over the other considerations. So it's very alarming, these so-called guideposts. And I think that litigators are going to be very hesitant to appeal these to federal courts now, given what the Supreme Court has done.
Yeah, exactly. When I was on the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we had a fulsome discussion about whether we should use the courts at all now, given how they've been reshaped. I wanted to ask you about the Shelby County versus Holder case, Marjorie. What's the meaning of this 2013 Supreme Court case? It struck down Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act that required pre-clearance of new voting rules in jurisdictions with a history of racial discrimination. That was the first blow against the democracy in voting, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, and it was very serious. This was in 2013. John Roberts wrote for the majority and struck down Section 5, saying we don't need it anymore. Basically, racial discrimination's over in voting. That's what they were saying in so many words. And this, as you said, in jurisdictions that had a history of racial discrimination, the Department of Justice would have to give preclearance to any voting changes or voting rule changes. Interestingly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote in the dissent to the Shelby case, quote, throwing out preclearance when it has worked and is continuing to work to stop discriminatory changes is like throwing away your umbrella in a rainstorm because you're not getting wet, unquote. And in his opinion, majority opinion in Shelby, Roberts said, don't worry, we still have Section 2, that will protect Voting Rights Act, and then, of course, the Voting Rights Act, and then, of course, he was one of the six right-wingers who drove a stake through the heart of Section 2. And it turns out that that for years, Roberts has had it in for the Voting Rights Act. A lot of this is coming out now. He's always been wanted to really do away with it, and it really has pretty much eviscerated the Voting Rights Act, this new decision. I think it's the most disturbing decision that the Supreme Court handed down for this term.
Yeah, I agree with you. I remember back in the 1980s when Reagan was the president and all this right-wing stuff started up. Roberts and Alito were both in the Justice Department in the Reagan administration. So they've lived long enough to cause even more trouble. But there are two federal voting protection bills that are now pending in Congress, Marjorie, and they've been introduced by the Democrats. Talk about those two bills and what they might do if they get passed.
Yes, well, the For the People Act protects voting rights and the administration of elections, takes aim at money in politics, requires government transparency and redistricting, and has ethical provisions. And then the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act protects voters in states with a history of a pattern of discrimination, and it ensures that last-minute changes in voting procedures don't endanger people's right to vote, and it protects voters from changes likely to disenfranchise people of color and language minorities. The problem is, with the filibuster, they're not going to go anywhere, and Manchin and Sinema, the two blue dog Democrats that are holding out on eliminating the filibuster, are really providing a roadblock and helping the Republicans to defeat or to not have a vote on these two laws, which would really go a long way to diluting the horrific effect that this Brnovich decision will have on voter suppression laws. And there are many of them that are pending now. Since Shelby was decided in 2013, at least 880 bills have been introduced in 49 states. And so you can imagine many of them have been enacted. We know about, you know, the Texas law and the Georgia law, which criminalizes giving food and water to people in line. In Texas, the Democrats had to decamp to Washington, D.C. to avoid allowing this horrible voting rights, voting suppression law to be passed. And we're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see a real proliferation of, after the Brnovich case, even more voter suppression laws. And so even if the Democrats in an election, for example, had more votes, it doesn't matter because their votes are being suppressed by, even though more voters would vote for Democrats, they're being suppressed by these voter suppression laws, gerrymandering, et cetera. So it's very, very alarming, goes straight to the heart of our very system.
Yeah, well, the Republicans are a minority party. They know that, and they know the only way they can get in is if they can fix these election laws. It reminds me of something that President John F. Kennedy said. He had a sense of history, and he said, those who make peaceful change impossible make violent change inevitable. And with the Republicans doing like this, it's really a frightening prospect for this country. Marjorie, before we conclude this topic and speak about Julian Assange, which we both agree is the most important First Amendment case on the horizon, I wanted to ask you if you had any final thoughts on the voting situation before we take the second half of our opportunity to interview you to talk about Julian Assange.
When the Supreme Court upheld the out-of-precinct policy, Kagan pointed out that in 2012, about 35,000 ballots throughout the country were thrown out because they were cast at the wrong precinct, and nearly a third of them were cast in Arizona. And she reminded people that Biden beat Trump by just 10,457 votes, and the votes thrown out in Arizona for being cast at the wrong precinct were 10,979. And the other thing, when the court upheld the ballot harvesting provision, saying, well, it didn't really create a disparate burden on people of color, Kagan retorted that it disproportionately impacted Native American communities who didn't have regular access to mail service, and almost half of them don't have cars. So even though there was evidence of strong evidence of discrimination, nevertheless, the Supreme Court upheld those two provisions. And again, as we've said, that does not bode well for the future.
Marjorie Cohn, let's talk about the Julian Assange situation. What did he do? Why is the United States looking to extradite him from a prison where he sits now in London, and bring him over here and put him into American prison? Start off with, what did he do, and what does the United States want to do to him, and why?
Well, Michael, Julian Assange had the temerity to reveal evidence of U.S. war crimes, and that's something that the U.S. government just can't tolerate. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks published evidence that was provided to them by Chelsea Manning. And just briefly, in 2010 and 2011, WikiLeaks published evidence of war crimes the U.S. military had committed in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo. That's the basis for 17 charges against Assange under the Espionage Act, and 400,000 field reports about the Iraq War, 15,000 unreported deaths of Iraqi civilians, evidence of systematic torture, murder, and rape after U.S. forces handed over the detainees to a notorious Iraqi torture squad. WikiLeaks published the Afghan war logs, 90,000 reports about the war in Afghanistan, which revealed more civilian casualties by coalition forces than the U.S. military had admitted to, and the Guantanamo files, 779 secret reports that showed 150 innocent people had been imprisoned there for years, and it documented the U.S. government's torture and abuse of 800 men and boys in violation of the Torture Convention and the Geneva Conventions. But the most notable release by WikiLeaks was the 2007 collateral murder video, which depicts a U.S. Army Apache helicopter gunship in Baghdad target and fire at unarmed civilians. At least 18 civilians were killed, including two Reuters reporters and a man who tried to rescue the wounded. Two children were injured, and then a U.S. Army tank drove over one of the bodies, cutting it in half. And that is evidence of three war crimes under the Geneva Conventions. So that's what Julian Assange did. He had the gall to reveal evidence of U.S. war crimes. And people don't realize that because the corporate media doesn't cover that. But that's really what he did. And that's the basis for the 170-year sentence he's facing under the Espionage Act.
Yeah, well, he's got the entire, to use a euphemism, intelligence community against him. And unfortunately, I think that he's got Biden siding with the intelligence community, and they want to continue Trump's initiative of indicting him and trying to get him over here, extradite him from Belmarsh Prison, try him here, and put him away forever so that he can't do the kind of things he's been doing. But recently, there's been an admission by a key witness against Assange that should hurt the American case. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, there, I told you about the 170 years he's facing on the 17 charges under the Espionage Act for revealing the war crimes. But he's also facing 5 years for conspiracy to commit computer intrusion. In other words, they're trying to paint him as a hacker. And the reason they're trying to paint him as a hacker is because if he is a journalist, then that would violate the First Amendment. No journalist or media outlet has ever been prosecuted under the Espionage Act for publishing truthful information. The First Amendment allows journalists to publish material that was illegally obtained by a third person if it's a matter of public concern, and the U.S. government has never prosecuted a journalist or a newspaper for publishing classified information, an essential tool of journalism. So they're trying to paint him as a hacker. He's not a journalist, he's a hacker. And the first indictment, which charged him with this conspiracy to commit computer intrusion, was really completely neutered, I guess you would say, or debunked at Julian Assange's extradition hearing. The experts testified, the technological experts testified, that it would have been impossible for him to technologically to do what the government said Julian Assange was doing. And so he really, the hacking charge was very weak. So what the Trump administration did was to add in a second superseding indictment evidence, I put that in quotes, to bolster this conspiracy to commit computer intrusion, which again only carries 5 years. That's a lot, but it's not 170. But it carries 5 years. But they wanted to get around this, the fact that he's a journalist. And so the basis for this new evidence in the second superseding indictment was a man named Thor Darson. Thor Darson said Assange had encouraged him to, and worked with him and worked with other people to be a hacker. He had, you know, a bunch of evidence that he was, a bunch of allegations. Well, Thor Darson, whom the Department of Justice, the U.S. Department of Justice, had recruited to build its case against Assange, admitted to the Icelandic newspaper Stundin that he lied about these allegations, that they never happened. And Thor Darson is has a very long criminal record. So basically, the case is unraveling. The hacking case is unraveling. This is assuming that Assange was ever extradited to the United States and tried under this indictment. And you know, there would be real problems with proof. They'd have this really kind of cuts the guts out of the U.S.'s case. And one other thing I should say is that during the Barack Obama indicted more whistleblowers under the Espionage Act than all prior presidents combined. But he and Eric Holder and his administration looked at the Assange case and decided that since Assange was a journalist, that WikiLeaks had done nothing different than what the New York Times, The Guardian, Der Spiegel, Le Monde had done, which was published articles based on documents that Manning had leaked. The Obama administration was afraid of establishing a precedent that could chill investigative reporting about national security matters by treating it as a crime. So aside from the merits of the case against, or the lack of merits of the case against Assange, he is still, as you said, in a maximum security prison in London, and there was an extradition hearing with a number of witnesses, after which a British judge denied the U.S. government's request to extradite Julian Assange to the U.S. to face these 175-year charges. She really bought the Trump administration's arguments about him not being a journalist. In fact, she cited Thor Darson's testimony in several places. This was, of course, before he recanted. But the reason that the judge in England denied extradition of Julian Assange to the U.S. was on humanitarian grounds, because there was so much testimony that he would be held in a high security supermax prison in the U.S. He'd be held in solitary confinement 23 hours a day. Given the history of psychological torture that he suffered, according to the UN Special Rapporteur, when he was confined in Britain, he would be a candidate for suicide. And the judge in England said that the U.S. prison system couldn't protect him. So the Trump administration appealed, and the Biden administration is not dropping that appeal, and that's a real problem. And we need to make the Biden administration drop this case, this spurious case. So the High Court in Britain has just agreed to hear the U.S. government's appeal. And so, what did the Biden administration do? Instead of dropping the appeal, which is what they should do in protecting the First Amendment, they presented new evidence, which, as an appellate attorney, you don't present new evidence on appeal. You present new evidence at the trial, and they never presented this evidence at the extradition hearing. And they said, well, we're not going to put him in this supermax prison. We're not going to impose these special administrative measures in pretrial confinement. They didn't say that they wouldn't hold him in administrative segregation or other isolation. They said we'll give him clinical and psychological treatment, and any sentence he gets if he's convicted in the U.S. can be served in Australia. But, you know, first of all, it's too late to raise these arguments, and hopefully the British High Court will agree. But also, they left open, the Biden administration left open the possibility that if Assange ran afoul of the Bureau of Corrections in the U.S., he still could be subjected to these onerous isolation measures and put in high security prison. And not only that, Australia has to agree to allow him to serve any sentence in Australia. This is not something the U.S. government can guarantee. So stay tuned, basically. But, you know, Biden, who was anti-Assange when he was with the Obama administration, basically said that, you know, if he's a hacker, then he should be prosecuted, and this recantation of Thor Darson's testimony really basically destroys that particular argument.
Yeah, but nonetheless, Biden is going forward with this. Biden accused Assange of being, quote, a high-tech terrorist. So I'm very pessimistic about, we've got to marshal a huge defense movement for Assange. Otherwise, I'm afraid that they're going to do what they want to do to him. How can people follow your work, and how can they keep up with the Assange situation?
Well, I am active, and I think you are as well, on AssangeDefense.org. I'm active in the Los Angeles branch, but this is a national organization, and I'm also on the board of the national organization, AssangeDefense.org, A-S-S-A-N-G-E, defense.org. And I urge people to go to that website. It has transcripts from the hearing. It's got all kinds of analysis of the case and legal analysis. And in terms of my work, it's collected at MarjorieCohn.com. It's also available at truthout.org, where I write several columns every month.
And excellent columns they are, Marjorie. Thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder, for coming back to be on our show. And we'll contact you again as the voting rights situation unfolds, and also with the Julian Assange defense. So thank you again for being our guest on our show.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael, and thanks for your great work as well.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.